A little bit of review before we get into the new material tonight. We've learned two definitions of faith that build on each other. Faith is the assurance hope for of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. We're totally convinced that things we can't see exist. We can see them by faith. And then the second part is we must believe that God is and he's a rewarder of those who seek him. The faith wouldn't make sense if there wasn't a reward for having faith. And we've seen many examples of people living in, by faith in Hebrews chapter 11. We talked about Abel offering a better sacrifice than Cain. We talked about Enoch being taken up into heaven. Noah building an ark. Abraham leaving his home and being willing to sacrifice his son. Isaac and Jacob, recipients of the promise. Moses, he led the children of Israel out of Egypt. And Rahab, as she saved the spies that were spying on Jericho. Tonight we'll start in verses 32 and 34 of Hebrews 11. Now what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. So the writer is telling us that there's so many examples of faith that there's just not enough time or parchment in their case to write all the names down and all their stories. We'll take a little bit of time and go over some of these tonight, though. So start with Gideon. He was called to deliver Israel from the Midianites. What was the first task God gave Gideon to do? It had to do with idolatry. What's the first task God gave Gideon to do? What was that?
Tear down the high places.
Tear down the altar to Baal and the Asherah. So was that a popular thing for him to do? No. But it was the right thing to do. He did it by faith. How did Gideon choose his army to fight the Midianites? He started with 30,000 men, and God told him that's too many. Okay, there's a stage before that.
If you're just afraid and need to go home, go home.
Yeah, those that were afraid were sent home. That took it down to 10,000 men. Then, like Mariana said, they were asked to go get drink water out of the river. And those that brought the hand up to their mouth to drink were kept, and the rest were sent home. That left 300 men. So why go through these steps? Why narrow it down to 300 men? What was the point of all that?
So it's for you to stand against you.
To show that it was God doing and not giving
it
to the men.
Yeah, God didn't want them to think of their own might. They conquered the Midianites. Put a big exclamation point on it when only 300 men could destroy an army. So how did they defeat the Midianites? What did they do? They had two instruments they used. Not any swords. They used trumpets and torches. They blew the horns in unison and lit the torches and showed the light. Thoroughly confused the Midianites. And God turned them against each other in their confusion. So how was this an act of faith on Gideon's part? That's definitely not your conventional wisdom of taking 300 men to take on a whole army. Debbie?
Well, it seems like when you say that all these people went against conventional wisdom because nothing they did make sense.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, no, I can't do that. That's not possible.
Yeah, the key word is, I can't do that. But with God, all things are possible. Then there's Barak. What was Barak's story? Who sent him to attack the Canaanite army? Deborah? Debbie? Right.
Yeah, he was the leader of the army, but he wouldn't go without her because God was with her. He had the faith and he had the strength to still lead it, but he listened to the word of the prophetess, which was not the normal. Because faith in God's selection of the next one of her as a judge.
Okay. So, you get 10,000 men, and it says that the Canaanites had 900 chariots. Kind of like Humvees, I guess, in our day and age. I can't tell you how many men there was that go with 900 chariots, but it should have been thousands. So how many were left of the Canaanite army when the battle was over? The scriptures say that they destroyed them all. And Sisera, the general, escaped. Now that he came to his end. This is my granddaughter's favorite Bible story, she said. Tempeg through the temple. By Jael, a woman that Deborah said a woman would put an end to Sisera. So Barak acted in faith too, attacking an army stronger than his. Yeah, probably because Deborah had a link to God as a prophetess.
Right, but sometimes we feel better if we have somebody beside us.
That's true. Iron sharpens one, as iron sharpens iron, one man sharpens another. And there's Samson. Was he always a righteous man? No, not the kind of person you think would be used in the hall of faith. But how did he? Yet he showed faith in several ways. How did he do that? What were some of the things that Samson did to show his faith? Yeah, he destroyed the Philistine temple. He asked God for one last bit of strength to tear down the temple. He killed 1,000 men with the jawbone of an ass. Again, conventional wisdom says you don't go after 1,000 men with a bone in your hand. And then there's Jephthah. I wouldn't have. If I was making up the list, I would not have put Jephthah in it. What kind of man was Jephthah? I put down he was sketchy. Yeah, he's remembered by his vow he made. Before that, thought he was run out of town, basically, when he was younger. And then when the Israelites got in trouble, they sent for him to be their savior, their leader of their military, because they needed him. And what vow did he make before God when he went into battle? Right, the first thing that came out to meet him after he came back from battle, he was sacrificed to God. It turned out to be his daughter. And there's a whole controversy about whether he actually had a human sacrifice or what else. The point is he made a foolish vow and kept it. But why is he in this list? What was his good side? How did he trust God?
He kept his vow.
He had faith that God would give him victory. There's a more familiar name, David. What situations did David show his faith? That's when it stands out the most, I think. The vision I have of David was he wasn't shying at all when he had confronted Goliath. He basically told him he was going to die, and he ran towards him, sprinted towards him when they confronted each other. And David slung the rock, and the stone hit him in the forehead and killed him. Did David do it out of his own strength? No, he's acting in faith. Again, it's like conventional wisdom would have said that David was going to get slaughtered. But he threw out conventional wisdom when God's in control. Was David always on the right course? No, he had his shortcomings. Like most of these men and women we talk about, there's always weakness involved. They weren't perfect individuals. They weren't sinless. But the point is that God can still use them. And they overcame by showing their faith. And there was Samuel. He followed God's directions by selecting King Saul and also King David. How did he show faith in selecting King Saul? Was he in favor of making a kingdom? Samuel talked to God about it. Samuel was convinced that they were turning away from God by asking for a king. God said, go ahead and give it to him. That they're not rejecting you, Samuel, they're rejecting me. So Samuel acted out of faith and obeyed God and put the Saul into power. I think he had to show more faith by putting David into power, though. What was the situation with David? Yeah, Saul was going to be taken out of office. How the selection process with David turn out? What were the details of that? Saul was sent to his family, David's family, pointing the way there.
Saul's brother tried.
He tried out each individual brother, and God said, no, this is not the one. David was out in the field. As everybody thought, why would they? David, he was basically the runt of the family.
It was the most unlikely.
Most unlikely?
Yeah. In Samuel's eyes, what's this one? I can't see it, but.
Yeah, that's the whole point right there. He couldn't see. So Samuel obeyed. Then we talk about the prophets. All the prophets could have been used as examples of faith. They showed their faith in God when they delivered unpopular messages to Israel and Judah. How did Elijah show faith in the contest for the prophets of Baal? Pardon? Yeah, Elijah was sure how the outcome would be. He was convinced that God would make it clear who the real God was. The prophets of Baal danced around and slashed themselves and spent hours trying to get their so-called God to come down with fire and take their offering. But Elijah just doused his sacrifice with water, made it impossible to burn in human condition. The God set down fire to destroy it all. Debbie?
But then he had to show the weakness when Jezebel threatened
him. Yeah, just like every other person we've been talking about.
Yes, so he would stand up to all the Baal, but then she threatened him and runs him out.
They're not very consistent. But overall, he was a man of faith. And if we had used this extended list, the writer says they conquered kingdoms. What's an example of some of the men of faith who conquered kingdoms? We could talk about Jericho, who was the man of faith and fought in Jericho. Joshua. About all the, in the book of the Judges, each judge was asked to drive out an army that was there against the Israelites, an occupational army. And David conquered kingdoms. They performed acts of righteousness by judging evil nations. They followed God's plan of action. They followed the law of God and performed acts of righteousness. They obtained promises. An example of that would be when the judges were promised they could drive out the invasion armies. Okay, how about shutting the mouth of lions? Who do we know that did that?
Well, God did it. But Daniel was the one.
Daniel would be a good one.
What's that?
Daniel was a good one. I had two others here. David, when he was a shepherd boy, killed the lion and the bear. And Samson ripped a lion apart. About to quench the power of fire. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. They escaped the edge of the sword. I was thinking of David as fleeing from Saul. Escaped death many times. From weakness were made strong. Who can you think of as a good example of being weak and being made strong? Yeah, Samson. He became mighty in war. Jesus. Joshua, the judges, and David would be examples of that. The same men who put foreign armies to flight. Let's skip down to verses 35 and 36. Women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might attain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourging, yes, also chains and imprisonments. So you can think of somebody who's received back their dead by a resurrection. Right.
The lady that had provided the food and lodging for Elisha or Elijah maybe, and he laid on her son and he died, brought him back to life.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, Elijah and Elisha did something similar. There was a woman of Zarephath who Elijah restored her child, and the Shunammite woman, Elisha, restored her child. Some of them were tortured. The Greek word there used in Hebrews 11 refers to being stretched over like a drum skin over a frame. And they think it meant when they were scourged, they had stretched their skin out so it would separate more when they were stroked. Not accepting their release. What that means is that they did not deny their God when asked to, when given the opportunity to escape their torture. They took their sentence gladly and remained faithful to God. So they obtained a better resurrection. They could have escaped torture by denying God. That would have been a type of resurrection to come back from the dead, with a death sentence. They chose to accept the resurrection of the body as their reward and did not deny God, accepted their torture. There are mockings and scourgings. There's verbal abuse and physical abuse. There's chains and imprisonment. They were detained for their faith in God. For example, Jeremiah was put in stocks. Yes?
So are there specific people we know that this happened to, or is this like a general thing that these kind of things happen to those people?
There's not a name in the Bible for each one of these.
But just an overview of these kind of things.
Like the scourgings was pretty typical of torture. But we don't have a name in the Bible, in the Old Testament at least. In verses 37 to 40. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. So stoning was a pretty common method of execution in the Old Testament. There's one Zechariah, not necessarily the prophet Zechariah, but there was a Zechariah who was stoned in the Old Testament. And sawn in two, that sounds pretty graphic. But reading about this, this was another not common use, but rare use of execution. I always thought of it as being cut across the belly or something like that, but there's indications that it was done lengthwise from the head down to the... So people faithful to God went through that kind of torture? Yeah, what was us when someone speaks mean to us? We're told that we haven't resisted the blood, overcoming sin yet. And many have in the past. And they were tempted. And considering the context it's in, being stoned and sawn in two, this might be a temptation to deny God to escape the punishment. So that would be a difficult thing to go through, to understand what was going to happen to you and then given the out. All you have to do is deny God. But they didn't. Put to death with a sword. Prophets were killed in Elijah's day by Jezebel's army. They wore sheepskins and goatskins. It was not unusual for prophets to dress in this way. Who in the New Testament dressed this way? Yeah, John the Baptist. They were destitute, afflicted, and ill-treated. Basically a summary of the way that the heroes of the faith were treated in the past. And I like this parenthetical expression in the middle here. The world was not worthy of them. The evil world we live in did not deserve to be the home of such men and women. They were honorable and they lived in an evil world. But they transcended the character of the world. It was all done by their faith. They live in deserts and mountains and caves and holes, not in palaces per se. They're many times on the run. But they gained approval through their faith. And this is something that's been coming up off and on through chapter 11. They were given a good report because of their faith. And it reminds us of what Abraham said of Abraham, that his faith was credited to him as righteousness. That we don't deserve to be righteous, but if we have faith, God promised to consider us righteous because of the sacrifice of his son. But they did not receive what was promised. Now, we just mentioned a bit ago that some received promises. But here it says they did not receive promises. So what's the difference? I think these promises here are talking about the promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That these men did not totally, completely recognize or accept or receive the promises. But we are provided something better ourselves because we've seen the culmination of the promises in Jesus Christ. We are blessed with the promises that do their life's work. They would not be made perfect, but because of what they did, we have become perfect, completely blessed. The fulfillment of the promises was not complete for them, but it is for us. Then I want to spend a little bit of time in chapter 12 because the first two verses, I think, go along well with what we just finished, chapter 11. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, this great cloud of witnesses, I looked up to the words cloud and witness in Thayer's. Cloud means a large, dense multitude or a throng. So here's a large group of people. We've only just touched the surface of the names of these people in chapter 11. But there's thousands of people who live by faith and are examples to us. The word witness there means those who, after his example, have proved the strength and genuineness of their faith in Christ by undergoing a violent death. So witness is akin to a martyr in this context. There's a great cloud of martyrs who have left their example for us to follow and to be encouraged by. Now, it's just, sometimes we get the word, we take the word witness and think it means they were eyewitnesses of what's going on earth. But that's not the meaning here. It doesn't mean that they were watching the newsreels of what's going on earth. We're asked to lay aside every encumbrance and sin that entangles us. The encumbrance is a weight or a burden, and that easily entangles us is defined as skillfully surrounding somebody. So we have a burden or weight of sin that skillfully tries to surround us and entangle us. But what we need to do is run with endurance the race set before us. Endurance is defined by Thayer's as, in the New Testament, the characteristic of a man who is not swerved from his deliberate purpose and his loyalty of faith and piety by even the greatest trials and sufferings. So it means you're going to, when you face trials, even facing death, they endured it and kept their loyalty and faith. The word race there has an interesting meaning. Comes from the assembly of the Greeks at their national games, hence the contest for a prize at their games, or generally any struggle or contest. So we're to endure that race, even though that race might lead through death. And as we're doing that, we fix our eyes on Jesus. The fixing our eyes there means to turn the eyes away from other things and fix them on something. So it's like you've got blinders on and you're only seeing Jesus and not seeing the things around you. You've got them locked in a death stare, not willing to look away from his eyes. He's the author and perfecter of faith. The author is one that takes the lead in anything and thus affords an example, a predecessor in a matter, a pioneer. Jesus showed us the way. He was the best example we could ever have. He was a pioneer in showing us the way to heaven. And the word perfecter there is one who has in his own person raised faith to its perfection and so set before us the highest example of faith. Like I said, he's the greatest example of faith we could have. He endured the cross and despised the shame for the joy set before him. Endure means to bear bravely and calmly all ill treatments that come your way. So he bravely accepted the cross. And despise means to disdain or think little of or nothing of. So with all the shame that he endured, he thought it a very little thing. And he did that because he knew he would be standing on the right hand of God. For the joy he saw, he was him being glorified with the Father. We should have the same perspective as he did. We will be glorified too if we remain faithful. So here's a couple final questions. We've spent 4 weeks talking about these heroes of faith. Why did this chapter appear in Hebrews? Why all this talk about faith? Fred?
Without him, you can't please God. It is real.
That's true. What do you know about the theme of Hebrews that would help you verbalize this? Yeah, all these characters from the Old Testament, what's the defining characteristic that makes them acceptable to God?
Faith.
Faith. What were the converted Israelites of Jesus' time tempted to do? Go back to the law of Moses. And this chapter 11 is showing that all these men in the law of the Old Testament were acceptable to God because of their faith. And you don't want to leave that. You want to keep the faith and not go back to something where you're counting on the perfect keeping of the law. So what did the recipients of this letter need to learn? Now, salvation and your reward were always based on faith, never based on a perfect keeping of the law. They were asked to stand firm in the gospel, and it's what all these heroes were pointed to. All these heroes were showing that faith is the way to please God, not by keeping the law perfectly. So going back to the law didn't make any sense at all. You're giving up the very thing that everybody in the Old Testament exhibited when they were pleasing to God. Well, that's where we're going to end tonight. And Mike, can we have you sing, lead us in a couple songs?